This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. What does it take to be a great investigative journalist? Curiosity, perseverance, or perhaps the ability to coerce or manipulate people to give you truths that you really don't want to say. Elspeth Frank is this character in The Missing Mother by Marley Cornish. Welcome, Marley.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, where has Elspeth made her success as an investigative journalist?
So she lived in New York following leaving Geelong, which is her hometown. She moved to New York and is an exceptional reader of characters, and that gets her very quickly streamlined into being an investigative journalist.
And she wrote a bestseller too, which she helped did, with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, on the tech bros, I think we say.
We learn a little about her. So let's hear about Elspeth Frank.
Absolutely. I'm typically an excellent reader of rooms, judger of characters, identifier of assholes. Give me a cocktail bar in 5 minutes and I'll be able to tell you who's broke, who does acid on the weekends, who was sexually assaulted at a college party. It's a curse and a blessing. On the one hand, it means I'm good at job interviews, dinner parties, anything front-facing and brief.
So she's a very good reader of people, which makes her a great reporter. But on a first date, we also know she is manipulative.
Yes.
She's getting Garrett to come back to her house so she doesn't have to pay the full taxi fare. And also on this date, we learn she has a thing about knives. She also has a problem with husband Keith and her. He has threatened to call the cops, so she needs to get out of New York and succumbs to answering her sister's phone calls. But before we get into that phone call, her sister is living quite a different lifestyle. So what's Aoife doing?
So Aoife is living back in Geelong, where Elspeth and her grew up together in a very bohemian sort of mansion by the sea in a suburb called Drumcondra. And Aoife is living the classic sort of middle class life. She's got two children. She's got a stable job at a local Catholic school, and she's got an apparently very happy marriage.
A plain life, this is a quote. White bread with the crusts cut off. They will buy a boring house and two boring cars and have boring children and boring lives. And Aoife will be content with that. Now, that's a quote from the mother. This is certainly not what their childhood life was like. Before becoming her mother, what life experiences did Simone have?
So Simone was the artistic muse for Elspeth and Aoife's father, who is quite a prominent and well-known, I guess, baby boomer would be the right generation, artist. And it was sort of loosely inspired by Brett Whiteley and that school of artists. A lot of drug use, a lot of instability, but also a lot of brilliance to make up for it. And that's the world that they inhabited as children.
So Simone met Robbie Frank and had moved in with him only after knowing him for a week. They got married when she was very pregnant and had two daughters, and they moved into the big house in Geelong. And this is another quote. Mother lived to entertain, to delight, to impress. And so Elspeth and Aoife grew up in a big communal house. Was it a happy house?
Well, that probably depends on who you ask. I imagine if you ask either of the parents and it occurred to them to think about how their children were experiencing it, they would probably say yes. But when you look at how Elspeth and Aoife have turned out, it suggests that probably there were some troubling things that happened in that house.
The book starts with a family remembrance, and they all remember it differently. And they all tell different ways about it. So what is that family remembrance?
The book opens with Simone, the mother, setting fire to a bunch of Robbie's artworks in the backyard, and is an event that is turned to again and again over the course of the book. And one of the things that we're interested in is, why are they doing this? What happened that led Simone to be so angry with her husband that she would set fire to his works?
To all his artworks. Well, exactly what happened was that he left her. The father walked out. And not long after the father's disappearance, their mother takes up with Frank's best friend, Richard. Elspeth finishes school. And then at 18 years old, what does she do?
She disappears to New York, never to be heard from again.
She's now 38 mm-hmm. in New York and, quote, has had her cheeks hoiked with fillers and her small frown marks frozen away. She hasn't seen her sister in 20 years. What's the phone call that brings her back to Geelong?
Elspeth is ignoring, steadfastly ignoring her sister's phone calls when she finally picks up, almost by accident, because she's kind of half asleep. It's to Aoife telling her that their mother has disappeared in mysterious circumstances.
Very mysterious. And so she comes back, the house is a crime scene. But what are the police looking for?
Well, they're looking for Simone in the first instance and trying to figure out what on earth has happened that would lead this apparently very popular, very effervescent and charming person to potentially be harmed.
Simone has told people that she's writing her memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened to the manuscript?
Well, yeah, this is the great mystery at the centre of this novel. And one of the things that I did really enjoy doing with it was being able to write from Simone's perspective, because I don't know. I personally found her quite delightful. I really liked her. I thought, you know, she's one of those people that you enjoy talking to at parties but wouldn't want to rely on for anything.
Well, in Elspeth's job as an investigative journalist, she's had a bit to do with police. And her reading of Detective Alan Grimshaw from page 42, I think this was rather eye-opening.
I dealt with cops in the States from time to time. Mostly meaty men with tough guy accents and vicarious trauma. They drowned in blue-collar beer. This was the Australian version. He was middle-aged, powerfully wide, his body the physical manifestation of authority. His hands, larger than mine, had a gold band on the fourth finger that looked too tight and cut into me as he shook my own in greeting. His voice was deep, with a pleasant, mature sort of timbre to it, as though he'd been a smoker many years earlier. The eyes, though, were busy, scanning my face, looking for family resemblances, for discomfort, for guilt. I felt instinctively that he was not a man who liked women, particularly those who did not conform to his expectations.
They don't have a very good relationship. The police warn her not to speak to Steve McKay.
Mm-hmm.
She recognises his curious eye and scavenger presence, a professional pest. But she does speak with him.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I think she wants someone that she can confide in and someone that she can be her true ugly self around. And she feels a sort of simpatico with him because he does the same type of work as she does, that nasty sifting through other people's misery type of work.
And he also knows why she had to leave her job in New York. So there's a bit of blackmail over there. Staying with her sister, she realised that the marriage is under a bit of a strain. And between visiting her childhood home, now a crime scene, and the family press conference, what does she do?
She decides, having gone to the family home, that the best and most responsible thing she could possibly do is go drinking at a local bar.
And it's at this local bar she meets Hans, who she had a bit of a crush on back in year 12, and had a party at her house, and then something happened between Hans and her mother. So anyway, Hans gives her a few drinks and she just comes to this press conference very badly. There's twists and turns in this book, not who is good and who is bad, but the changing motivations. Now, Mary Cornish, hopefully it isn't your clients in your family lawyer practice giving you ideas.
No, absolutely, definitively not. What I would say, though, is one of the things that strikes me about practicing family law is that, and indeed other types of law as well, is people come to you with their version of the truth. It's their truth, but that is often quite different from objective truth. And that was one of the things that I was doing in this book. We see Simone's version of events. We see Elspeth's and Aoife's. And they're all factually different. But the emotional truth, I think, is tightly held. They genuinely believe what they've experienced is the correct version of events.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, it's a crime book with no dead bodies. Do you think that missing persons gives the reader more hope as an outcome?
Yeah, that's what appeals to me, I think, about this trope. There is a real sense of hope in this, in the possibility that things might work out okay, even as, you know, they're probably not going to.
Oh, they're not. We do need to know who she was having dinner with the moment she disappeared. Well, we would like to believe Elspeth, a successful investigative journalist, is telling the truth. But when it comes to her own family, she is damaged. Readers will not be sure whether they can feel for her or fear her. Marley Cornish has many twists and turns in The Missing Mother. Oh, look, it was a good book.
Thank you. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
And if you want to hear more, I know Marley is going to be talking at a Sisters in Crime event. It's called The Gone on Friday the 26th of June at the Rising Sun. You can have a look in Sisters of Crime and find out more. We didn't get into the knives and the 38. What's the number with 38 that you've got going?
38.
Yep. 38. It had been 38 years since Simone's mother's death. Simone was 38 when Elspeth left for New York, and Elspeth was 38 when she came back to Geelong.
So I think one of the things, without giving away too much of the plot, is that Elspeth is constantly trying to find meaning and purpose in things external to herself, and this search for numbers is part of that.
And the search for the reason about the knives is also there. Mm. Well done, Marley Cornish.
Thank
well
you.
Done. The mother who's writing the memoirs, we'll give her the last word because it's going to be a segue into David's guest. How can you confine a moment, a life, to a few thousand words? How can you create a scene of such intricacy and beauty in the space of a single sentence and have your heart broken twice by the end of a paragraph? It would take me years to achieve either of those things.
And you need help to write those paragraphs.
Segue.
Because we're on about publishing and writers, and published or not is encouraging people to bring their books in and write. But my guest today works for the Wheeler Centre, which has been encouraging writing for quite some time. And we discovered before we came on air that even the earlier incarnations of the Writing Centre supported a version of Published or Not before we even got here. But Xanthia O'Connor is here from the Wheeler Centre to talk about the next chapter, which is a program that the Wheeler Centre are running. So, Xanthia, welcome to 3CR.
Thanks so much, David. It's lovely to be here.
Now, a very quick question, just to set the background. The Wheeler Centre, what's it offering? What's it generally providing?
Yeah, so the Wheeler Centre was started, I think, 16 years ago now, due to Melbourne getting its UNESCO City of Literature designation, the second in the world, just behind Edinburgh. They just got in before us. But yeah, so the Wheeler Centre was sort of built to support the City of Literature office, which still exists up in the Wheeler Centre. Yeah, so it basically acknowledges that Melbourne is a city for writing and for literature and also readers as well. It's, yeah.
But the Wheeler Centre are now doing something specific in that regard, and it's called The Next Chapter, and it's a program to encourage writers. In general, what is The Next Chapter? What's it doing?
Yeah, so the Next Chapter is a development program for emerging writers that have a manuscript or are starting a manuscript and are looking for support. And that is in the way of money, in the way of mentorship, and just carving out time and space to really finesse a manuscript ready for publication.
Well, all of the development that goes into a manuscript before they come into Published or Not to talk about it. We should actually make this part of what the next chapter is offering. You get an interview.
That'd be great. Love that. Of course. I'll bring them in.
No worry. There's a queue already at the door. But your CEO, Erin Vincent, mentioned in one of his comments that you're bringing it back. So what happened to it? Did it get lost? Did it come back? What's the story?
Look, I'm sure no one will be surprised in the current economic climate. We had some funding issues for a few years there, and we were just working to diversify the people who were funding the next chapter looking for more philanthropic help, looking for government funding as well. And we are really happy now that, you know, we've got quite a few really, really generous, beautiful funders for the next chapter. So, yeah, it's just I feel really confident now that we're back and able to fund it a little bit more, you know, sustainably.
to keep it the momentum going. Australian stories. It's another comment in the flyer that's come out. Mm. Australian stories that aren't necessarily being published. That's worth unpacking, I think. Mm. What is an Australian story?
I mean, an Australian story is very broadly defined. So it does not have to... We do not choose books that are set in Australia or have strong Australian themes. The only thing that makes it an Australian story, I guess, in our remit is that it is written by somebody that resides in Australia.
Well, it's the evolution of what we see as being Australian.
Absolutely.
Because we've got so many voices
exactly.
now.
Yeah.
But the fellowship isn't just monetary. We can mention there's $15,000.
Yeah, there's on just offer. A little $15,000 in there for
that,
you.
That would help pay a week's good. Rent or two. But there are other aspects here that are being mentioned. The peers, agents, mentors, publishers, and now broadcasters. But those elements, how essential are they above the writing, above and beyond the writing, of meeting up with peers, of having agents, of having mentors? What's important about them in terms of developing writing?
Yeah, I mean, to publish a book, and Marley, I'm sure that you agree, it takes a village of people to get a book off the ground.
Yeah.
And so as many people as basically you can have in your corner as a writer, we always think of it as this solitary time, and a lot of it is, but then so much of it as well is finding your people to help your work come to fruition. Like that's one of the biggest things for it's such an honor to see writers start with just that 10,000 words and by the end of the year go to having a publisher or just being really curious about what where they want to go and who they want to talk to.
But also finding the right mentor for the style and the voice that the author is using.
Absolutely.
Is important.
Yeah. So that's one of the really, the biggest things at the start of the year, the start of the mentorship year, is working with those writers and figuring out what they actually want out of a mentor. Because Sometimes writers will come in and they have a really clear idea or they've worked with someone previously and they're like, oh, look, I would love another year of working with this writer or this editor, please. That person is great. And we go to them and it's a really easy
association. Yeah,
yeah.
Transaction. Yeah.
And that's really wonderful to see. But then there's other writers that will come in and they're like, look, I've never been mentored before. I'm not really sure. I really love these sorts of writers and I really love this book. And we have quite a few conversations, like, you know, 3, 4, 5 conversations of, you know, talking about what they actually want, whether that be, oh, I want someone who is in Melbourne. So we have, you know, we can meet in person, or in Sydney, so we can meet in person because it is a national program. Or they're like, I don't really mind about that, but, you know, I really want someone with a strong editorial vision or like really strong editorial background, you know, and that sort of thing. Or I want someone that's culturally similar to me and will be able to like shepherd me through this process of publishing in a largely, you know, can be quite homogeneous in an industry.
But yeah. Now we get to the funding, and this is a sort of connection, another segue to Published or Not next week, where we're trying to get our funding together so we can stay on for another year. So that's why we have our radiothon. But you've got contributors, fellowships. So there's the Malcolm Robertson Fellowship, and that's got a specific focus.
Yes, that's for a poet specifically, yeah, which I love that we've got lots of different funders now, which I think is similar to your radio program, is that it takes all of your funders to build the program and keep it running for as long as it has. And I feel like similarly with the next chapter, we've we've got a lot of different people helping out.
You've got the Mietta Foundation.
Yes.
They're more general, more diverse.
They haven't, they have not put a specific genre on their funding place. They are open to any and everyone.
to just foster, words and writing. The one that I saw was the John Clark Award.
Yes, we have the John Clark Fellowship that's going to a humour writer, which unfortunately is not, only happens every second year. So for this year, the John Clark Humour Fellowship is not happening, but that does not mean that humour writers cannot apply for the other categories, because we love humour writing. And also humour writing is one of those things that sometimes is a little bit genrefied, a little bit hard to get published, and you want to, sometimes those sorts of, people might need that little bit of extra help in that way of, figuring out where they fit.
We all need a good laugh now and then.
Oh, we really
do. in many ways, this is more than just the writer benefiting. So, we're talking about the writers, $15,000, mentors, all of that sort of thing. Who else benefits in general?
Well, the Australian public, obviously. We've had some brilliant writers come out of the Next Chapter program. Evelyn Araluen was in our first year with her work Drop Bear, and that was just such a beautiful honour. That was before my time, sadly, but we keep very we're still very close with Ev, and Evelyn is actually mentoring one of our fellows this year, which is wonderful. So and then I guess we really benefit from these stories, as I said, like coming to fruition and becoming novels where, people can resonate with these works that they might not have seen before. Like just coming to mind, for example, a previous fellow, Jumana Abdu, published a beautiful novel called Translations of a Muslim woman going to rural New South Wales and finding a home there after domestic violence. And I had just never read anything like it. It was incredible. Like, what vision for this, like, quite genrefied, a woman, single woman goes to a rural town, but it have this identity that you don't see as often.
But this is what's happening in Australia. So it helps Australia, if I can put it that way, to find these connections, to find that resonance. And it makes for a healthier community in many ways. So it's not just the author that benefits. It's an annual offering. How long are we able to sustain this for? Another question for Published or Not, year-by-year proposition. Is this locked in, do you think, for long term?
Look, it's definitely still year by year with our fingers crossed every year with, going to as many different funders as we can, and hopefully the work that comes out of the Next Chapter continues to speak for itself. We've got a lot of enthusiasm with what the writers are producing, which is really exciting from publishers, from funders, and just from the public more generally. So,
and now for the very important question. How does one apply?
Yes. You can go to the Wheeler Centre website, and it's under the opportunities tab there, the Next Chapter. Just apply there. We're open till the 31st of July. So if you're like, I've got like 1,000 words, not 10,000 words, and I need some time to think about who I want my letter of support to be and, those sorts of things, you've got almost 2 months. So you're good.
But there'd be a number of people out there with a manuscript in their bottom drawer.
Oh, yeah.
Ready and waiting.
I think we all could think of a few.
So,
Can we ask, Marley, how did you first get published?
I did the literary speed dating through the Australian Society of Authors.
Amazing.
I pitched to Martin. He was the only person I pitched to. He's still my agent today. And he has taken the two manuscripts I produced to publication. So I had a comparatively easy ride in the scheme of things, I would say. Yeah, I was very lucky.
That's so great. Martin Shaw is such a good advocate
for
his writers.
Yeah,
so great.
So that sort of brings us to the end of another week, Jan, but I think we need to...
A new chapter next week. Victorian Rome.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.